Welcome to Love Nature, the Biophilia Podcast, a product of the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. Now here are your hosts, Dr. Eric Dorfman and Dr. Dan Dombrowski.
Welcome, everybody, to our second episode of Love Nature, the Biophilia Podcast. This is Dr. Dan Dombrowski.
This is Dr. Eric Dorfman.
And we're here today to finish up our interview and opportunity to talk to Dr. E.O. Wilson. So very exciting.
Yes, absolutely. It was such a great first half of that and really looking forward to the next. We'll also be talking a little bit more in depth about E.O. Wilson's newer book, Half Earth, Our Planet's Fight for Life, and the idea about saving half the planet for conservation.
What a great idea, too. I think, you know, as we talk more about biodiversity and the importance of nature to people and getting people into nature, you know, I think we've got to come up with some plans to save nature, right? I mean, we're losing biodiversity so quickly that I think the first step has to be just kind of slowing that process down and finding ways that we can save nature.
Absolutely. It's also a really thoughtful take on what it is. You know, it's not slicing the planet up like an orange and saying, okay, this half is being reserved. It's really taking the best of the best, the biodiversity hotspots that really will make the biggest impact. So there's a lot to digest and a lot to think about with this. One of the things that I like that we won't be covering in any detail in this book is the way that there's a big chapter in the book that really looks at some of the various important places that if we were going to do this really should be high on the list. And it goes through continent by continent looking at the Earth's biodiversity hotspots or in some cases people's favorite spots. You know, he's gone to thinkers in conservation to ask what they think. I was wondering, Dan, what's your favorite place if you had to set aside somewhere in the world?
Wow, that's that kind of puts me on the spot. So
I didn't think about that. This was not premeditated.
Okay,
I was just thinking because I don't know what I would ask.
I would have to say, and again, I really do love the concept. I think that not only the idea of 50-50. People really relate to you get half, I get half. But in this case, when we're talking about preserving or conservation, that half doesn't exclude people, right? So that's a place or those are places where we can coexist, that we let nature take its course and not try to shape and rule those areas. But definitely people are part of that. As far as my favorite, a couple things come to mind. One would have to be a marine habitat and places like the Great Barrier Reef that, you know, people don't.
You picked mine.
Well, sorry about that. Great minds think alike. There you
go. It's true.
But yeah, I think that we don't see that, you know, people aren't up close to it, but it's so important. And there's just so much going on in places like that. And it's life is so concentrated. There's so much to learn. And I just think that, you know, we've got to do better about preserving or conservation in those places that we don't always get to see and are a little bit farther away. Places like that also with changes in temperature, with climate changes, that they can really be vulnerable to changes in either the environment or in the climate. And so I think, again, that would be my pick or my target area.
Well, you know, so that was absolutely it. Not that you did ask me, but if you were going to, that is what I would have picked too. And the one thing, it's a great example, actually, the Great Barrier Reef, because it, you know, one of the things that's really hurting the reef is agricultural runoff, right? It's not just climate change. And so when we think about the things, sure, you can set the, I mean, it already is set aside as a World Heritage Site, but what about all of the man-made influences, I should say, anthropogenic influences that are hurting the reef that aren't being regulated or not being regulated to the degree that they could be? So obviously, climate change is its own issue, but right, how do we deal with agricultural runoff, which is every bit as devastating to this very delicate environment?
Some of what we need to do is just get people to start thinking about these things. I think sometimes the connections aren't obvious when you talk about a habitat that people don't see. And then you talk about these influences or these effects that are from areas or places or activities that are hundreds or thousands of miles away. I think, you know, our job is to help people make those connections and really just introduce them to the ideas and to the potential issues that we need to face or problems.
But it's also understanding the complex web of influences on any given habitat. Setting aside a place as a reserve is only one step, but we really have to think very holistically about all of the influences that that make that place actually secure from the point of view of the ecological systems that are happening around it and within it. Right. And that's a really important part of it.
I think, too, that, you know, an approach that includes, again, nature including us, right? We've got to figure out how we fit and where we fit and how we can do this a united front. It can't just be, like you said, you can't just protect that 100 acres and cut it off from the rest of nature. You've got to think about how it connects. There have got to be corridors. You have to have access, whether it's other forms of life or resources. You've got to limit those things, the anthropogenic influencers or things that cause impact. You've got to, I think, look at that big picture, and it's all related and all connected. So
that's one of the reasons that island biogeography went from being physical islands in the middle of an ocean to land-based islands, where that's the last bit of habitat under a regime of highly altered landscape, and look at what those impacts are and how those things work. And it's a complex algorithm of processes.
I can't wait. I think Dr. Wilson will be here shortly. Have some questions. I have some questions for him.
Yes,
too.
I know. I tons of questions. Thank you. Yep.
Love Nature, the Biophilia Podcast, is a production of the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. Each episode explores our connection with nature on a personal, physical, and scientific level that enables us to live better and more responsibly on the planet. This podcast was made possible by a donation from the Burt's Bees Foundation and Burt's Bees to the Friends of the Museum of Natural Sciences. Now, on to our interview.
Something that I wanted to ask you, you know, it's a hard thing to think about the pandemic right now, but you know, when you were writing Half Earth 2016, it was a very different world, or 2015, I guess you wrote it and published in 2016, very different world from now. And do you think that the pandemic will play any part in how people view nature and our place?
Can we come to love, Corbin? I don't think so. But I think what we can come to have much more interest in the largely unexplored world of viruses.
Right.
The least parts of the world today, and I'm not even leaving the theme we were working on a minute or two ago, the least studied are bacteria and viruses. There is a wonderful career open to young scientists who will pick up on the study of the variety and the biology of bacteria and viruses generally. A field in its own, it's dependent in part on molecular biology, and it desperately needs closer attention.
The other part of that, too, is that we live in an environment. It kind of takes this idea back to people being a part of nature. This pandemic and a lot of these zoonotic diseases that we can pass between people and animals and in the environment, I think we're going to have to look really closely at our role in the environment and start thinking a lot more about it in those terms, too, just for human health reasons as we move forward. with our populations the way they are.
And it could cause us to be perhaps a little more humble about our ability to control our environment.
Well, well said. There's that added motivation for putting much more emphasis on what's called the prokaryotes, the organisms that are below the level in complexity and earlier and were earlier in evolution than most of the organisms we study. So, very badly needed. If we have the type of knowledge we need for viruses, some of which incidentally prey on bacteria, and we have a much fuller knowledge of bacteria, especially those that make up a large part of life in the soil, we would be able to draw from it a great many more practical applications, not only in the prevention of more pandemics, but also in the best, the most effective way of managing our natural environments, mostly leaving them alone, but also agricultural lands to get maximum productivity and security.
Thinking about what's happening with the pandemic too, the other phenomenon unrelated to this conversation really is the fascination and maybe even joy that people are having when they see wildlife coming back into the cities. You know, if you think on social media, there's just, they've gone wild to see boars and deer and things traveling down major streets that are empty of traffic. The turtles, sea turtles coming in and reestablishing on their breeding grounds.
I think that it ought to be part of the of urban planning, not just to have parks, but also to have parks if you have enough land, like Central Park in New York, of having not just parks, but of having wild areas within the park that are left alone as much as possible, except for a large number of people going through it and sitting on benches looking around in it. It can take the reintroduction of a large part of wildlife. They already have migratory birds, be allowed to have other animals, not dangerous to people, but part of nature that they ordinarily would not see unless they could travel out into the country.
That kind of brings up a question I've been dying to ask you about. And this is related to Half Earth and the concept of let's get a goal, let's call it half, 50-50. We all understand 50-50. How does that apply to people's yards or their backyards? You know, do you think it's if we could get everybody to set half their yard aside to be a wild place, like what significance do you think that would have in the bigger plan?
I think it could be very important. You can have small wild areas left in, well, if you you would have to have a fair amount of property, but a great many people do, and not just wealthy people in cities, but also other people who are making their livings off the land and are in areas where they have to live in places where the plots are pretty large. But these lots can count if left alone and managed to have the maximum amount of plant and animal species. They can certainly count as micro reserves to be added to that half total that I recommend. I might add that although that might sound extreme, one half of the earth for nature, it has taken hold as a principle in conservation organizations around the world and is seen by most people seriously as feasible. The questions that arise about its practicability have many solutions available. Congress has just passed, or is just about passed, it certainly passed the House of Representatives, Boundary Wildlife Boundary Conservation Act, which makes available ways for animals and then plants to traverse the borders of settled areas, including the United States. And basically, most countries have the ability around the world to set up natural areas simply by making them natural areas, and with no necessity, in most cases, of causing people to leave. It becomes an incentive for people already living there or close to it to actually participate in setting those areas up. I'm right now working with a group centered in Mobile, Alabama, to have a new national park established for the Mobile Chenzal Delta, which is a huge area of almost undisturbed bottomland next to the city of Mobile. And among the incentives for having that new national park, besides it preserves a lot of natural environment, much of it beautiful, is the large number of species of plants and animals that live there. Independent economic instant analysis of the income that a park like that could bring in surrounding commerce, the kind that go with national parks, people love them and come, is on the order of $100 million a year. So I think we're going to get our park.
And this sort of brings me what you've been talking about, a progress towards Half Earth. You know, you started thinking about this, you wrote about it 5 years ago. And I was just sort of wondering what our national and international report card is along these lines after 5 years. Do you think that we are following the trajectory you would have expected if we were going to succeed?
My impression is that the idea of half to nurture, I just picked that because measurements show that an area, as it increases by one half and left to nature, has an increase up to 85% of the species that were there before, even though the area around this protected area is altered so that those species disappear. That's an established principle, and it's one that's quite attractive. This has been, when I introduced it, the half earth, I just selected that because it seemed to me to be the right measure to have. It was very quickly accepted by most of the conservation organizations that I made contact. We were at shortly after publishing that, and it was being read. I was at the international conference on national parks, and it was universally accepted already. I don't know how much in terms of acreage around the world it's resulted in, but it certainly has been accepted as a principle worldwide. Once people understand that you're not making people who are in the best areas for such parks move, but quite the contrary, have them be agents, if they will, of preserving it.
Well, then this is where things like sustainable farming and that was something interesting that you mentioned too, actually, in Half Earth, was the idea that the, say, Anthropocene-driven concept of mixed use is not what you're talking about. You're talking about letting nature do its thing, really. So how do we deal with that part of the equation?
I think it's by utilizing the land that has not yet been developed. And there is, over the world, a large part of land in most countries that has not been filled in yet, is still natural or mostly natural. So those are the ones that you put together. And so this requires a new kind of mapping, but I don't think it's too difficult to do. We have a lot of land in the United States, for example, that could be added to bring us up, this country up to a half to nature goal, if we make that a goal. The new act that I just mentioned, that's before Congress, would not only make it possible for wildlife and species of plants to migrate across the borders, but also could make use of land everywhere affected by attention to wildlife crossing, which this act in Congress does attend to, setting aside of as much land as possible along corridors for allowing traffic, but establishing means, high overpass and so on, of allowing plants and animals to move back and forth across these borders. The land to do that is there for a large part of America's highways and byways, and made into local parks for nature would achieve not only the purpose of the act in terms of guiding or improving traffic and protecting wildlife crossing roads, but also would be fragments which put together, by definition, a step toward a much larger protection of wildlife in general.
When you talk about this half that we set aside for nature, you're not excluding people from that, right? Like this is like letting sort of the native wildlife drive the area, not the people, but people are still a part of that. Is that right?
Yes. I would say quite the opposite. You just encourage them. If you have, for example, in the case of fishing, and you have underwater reserves, which we have areas that professional fishermen or farmers, hunters, and so on make use of in ways that are amenable to keeping the area natural so that it can actually be better to keep, in many cases, maybe most cases, people living there to stay there and do what they were doing before. That, for example, is what happened with our greatest national park in the United States, and that's the Great Smoky Mountain National Park, where the people that had been living there for generations were allowed to just stay where they were. And it's been a good combination.
This is maybe a little bit of a silly question or a little off of the seriousness we've been on, but I would love to talk to you about my second favorite author or cartoonist. So when I was in college, this kind of got me through those long nights at the lab table, reading Gary Larson. And you actually wrote a foreword in There's a Hair in My Dirt. And that was another place that we saw biophilia mentioned. So I was just going to get your sort of take on that. Or what do you think about that? Or do you remember that book by Gary Larson?
I loved him. I was so unhappy when he stopped. He apparently felt that he had run out of good ideas. The humorous cartoons he had were very much diverted to engage, rather, scientists. And scientists loved it. They posted his published work on the walls, and it gave us a lot. I thought he was terrific. I don't know what happened, why he stopped. Maybe he went on to other things, probably did. That is bringing humor into scientific and technological endeavor and the things in life, other things in life that most people take as very serious and programmed.
I think it becomes a very quickly a dire situation if you can't laugh at it sometimes. Thank goodness ecologists have good senses of humor. It's interesting thinking about that. You know, I was reflecting that the Earth's human population between your book Biophilia and Half Earth essentially doubled from 3.7 billion to 7.7 billion in that intervening time. And it's, I know.
We can still handle that number, but it's getting tougher. I mean, and leave a large part of the world to nature, but it's getting tougher and tougher. And runaway human population is fundamentally the greatest threat that the rest of life on Earth is facing. And there's no reason why we should continue in different ways and for different reasons to promote runaway population. We should find ways of controlling it so that everyone can have a family, but they also can have an environment worth living in.
And you did talk about how you felt the algorithm would go, that you, when we reach about 9 billion, something like that, it will become self-regulating, the human population, which is an interesting thought, you know, that will just naturally decrease over time. And that's the other thing that I wanted to mention, is how you thought, or to ask you, how you thought climate change interacted with the idea of half Earth, right? If the places that we choose, and there's this wonderful chapter in Half Earth where your colleagues from around the world chose their favorite or their, well, I suppose, favorite places that we should take care of. But the quality of those places may change as, especially, say, in mountainous areas, coastal areas, as the climate changes. How do we account, if we are putting aside half the planet, how do we account for changing climate?
Climate change is certainly the worst thing we're doing to the planet, and it could ruin everything in time if just allowed to continue without some way of stopping it.
And do you think that will change our choices of what to preserve?
You mean of what the best one half would be?
Yes, exactly.
I think that, you know, that's a very interesting question. And I don't think that we have made enough progress on climate change, of changing minds and changing economies and religions. And we haven't made enough progress in mapping the Earth's biodiversity. As I said, most of it remains unknown to make a good judgment of what the long-term impact will be by either allowing land to be used up by a growing population or by selecting the right or wrong areas to preserve. We have to take each part that's available in turn and evaluate it. Another reason, incidentally, for more and more young people coming into science to participate in the censusing of the plants, animals, microorganisms, the biodiversity of those parts of the world that can be set aside, and those parts of the world that are not being set aside but need evaluation in terms of how they can be best managed with reference to the rest of life.
Well, it's the classic idea of the wicked problem, isn't it? There are so many different elements to it that it's really hard to get a handle on how it all happens. But
we've got to make a decision before too long because of population growth and the increasing industrialization of the world is in the way the natural products, including especially forest and arable land, are being taken up to support the growth, the population growth and the economic growth going with population growth. We have to move on that. And we have to do it now. If we really, as a couple of authors said recently, about climate change and what we have to do about it and have to do about it now. They use a phrase I like a lot. On climate warming, we are approaching the last exit or off the highway. And that's what we're doing, too, with biodiversity. Biodiversity and the saving of all of the other species, the 10 million or so that we think are out there, it's got to be done. That's going to be one of the next big things coming in the environment. The big thing in environment protection, study, and policy now is climate change and getting that under control. But that's only one of three environmental crises, I think, we have brought on ourselves. The second one is a shortage of fresh water. That's going to receive a lot more attention soon. That's around the world. It's creating potentially terrible problems, the loss, the using up of fresh water. But the second, or the third rather, is the destruction of biodiversity and the resulting collapse of natural environments. We don't know yet because we haven't done enough of the science to figure it out, just what the consequences will be as we allow more and more species, plants and animals, and although we don't know much about it, microorganisms go into extinction or at least a very low population. We know from at least a few studies that after a few key species are diminished or lowered in abundance, the large part of the whole ecosystem can collapse. So we're facing a future in which most people haven't even thought about it, that more and more species become more and more rare or even extinct, and that's what's happening. The natural environments that they occupy will be disturbed and maybe destroyed in some important way.
You mentioned in the book, you had the quote that you can't do just one thing, in that you can't take away a species from a collection and expect nothing else to happen. It's critical for this. And of course, we're taking out species at an unprecedented rate. So yeah, it's quite sobering.
One of the, I think, dilemmas with species conservation too, Ed, you called it the 100 Heartbeat Club. I feel like we wait until it's so late for some of these species and they're so rare, but then other common species like at the same time are also becoming rare, and we're sort of losing biodiversity on both sides of that. What do you think about those species or where efforts really need to be focused?
Well, returning to our earlier theme, another argument for having training, more specialists. We need more experts on different groups of organisms because the experts know which species are at risk. They know where they are, and they know what measures might be taken or must be taken in order to save them. You're quite right. There's a book entitled, I can recommend it, called The Rarest Birds in the World, which does go through the list of bird species around the world that have been judged to be extremely rare and getting rarer and on the verge even of extinction. Species after species covered in that book. It's a Bible, I suspect, for bird watchers, international bird watchers. Species after species have been studied enough by bird watchers and locals to know even how many individuals are left. And one after the other found to be still located in only one or two limited places in the world with only a very small number of individuals left, in some cases only a few hundred or even less. So we need expertise, we need the knowledge, and we need the recommendations made by specialists increasingly on different kinds of plants and animals and eventually microorganisms to keep them from, as one service to help keep them from going into extinction.
And then we also need the political will to enact that protection once we're able to articulate it.
I think that the will to save wildlife, or, you know, the biodiversity, the natural environment of the United States ought to be made one of the most important subjects for debate and planning in the forthcoming election.
Agreed.
This all started with the study of ants and the idea of superorganisms. I think it was in Biophilia talking about ants that form fungus, or maybe the fungus forms the ants. And my question is really, like, what did you learn from these superorganisms that we can apply to sociobiology and people?
Well, I'm bringing out a book in the next few weeks from publishing company W.W. Norton and within a live write wanted to avoid mentioning it. Just for ordinary ethical reasons. But the book coming out, the book title is Tales from the Ant World. And what I've done is to give, first of all, my own history of how I got into the study of ants, how I was encouraged to advance as far as I could while at the University of Alabama, and then on at Harvard, where I've been for many years. I take case by case of the rarest ants and how I hunted for them and the different kinds I studied. Also, a description of the extraordinarily strange ways of life that ants have invented in the course of their 150 million year evolution. That includes the fungus-growing ants. These are ants that cut leaves. They have casts that cut leaves, and other casts that carry them, and other casts that protect the nest, and so on. And the ones that cut the leaves bring it into the nest, and they process it. Another cast processes it. And the colony then is able to continue growing the one food it lives on, which is a kind of fungus that grows on the processed material processed by ants. Yeah, and they are among the most successful animals in the New World, ranging all the way from Argentina to the southern United States.
Sounds like a fantastic read. It's really wonderful. So, Ed, this has been such an amazing time, and you're so generous to have shared your wisdom and ideas with us. It's an amazing conversation, as I knew it would be amazing. Is there anything else that you feel like you'd like to share before we finish up?
No, I greatly appreciate your allowing me to enter subjects too that mean a lot to me.
Oh,
thank you very much.
Thank you. The founder of the concept Biophilia is sharing your ideas with us and allowing us, you know, to hopefully have this be a really successful podcast. I certainly hope there are other opportunities to connect.
Well, I thank you for the opportunity, and I wish you all success.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Love Nature, the Biophilia Podcast, a production of the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. You can listen or subscribe at anchor.fm/thebiophiliapodcast, or you can come to our website, naturalsciences.org. You can also visit the museum in beautiful downtown Raleigh. Details on our website.